Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 351 for October 13th of 2016. Everything you don't know about the Acura NSX. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Vasilash, it's so good to be sitting next to you.
John,
again.
How are you? Missed you last week.
I know, and I heard it was a good show. I haven't seen it yet, but I promise you, I am going to watch it.
It was a good show.
We used a little snippet of it in Autoline Daily, and I thought, ooh, that sounds pretty interesting.
More stuff about 48 volt, and it was very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
Different than we'd heard before, so it'd be, if you haven't seen it, watch it.
I promise you I will. Hey, we got to let everybody know we got Joe DiMatteo here from Road and Track magazine. Joe, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me back, John.
So,
Gary,
what have you been up to? Anything fun lately?
Driving cars, putting out a magazine.
That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Sounds like work, too, but work can be fun.
But there are plenty of people who want the job. So.
And now we got to let everyone know our special guest is in the studio, Ted Klaus, chief engineer with the Acura NSX. For those of you outside of the U.S. market, it's the Honda NSX, but it's the same car. So thanks for being on the show with us today.
It's great to be here.
Do you run into any problems, Acura NSX, Honda NSX, when you're talking to people about the car?
No, I really don't. I really don't.
There's no confusion in your mind.
In my mind, it's the pinnacle product of Honda Motor Company, and it's very appropriate that it's an Acura in North America, where we basically brand our pinnacle ideas as a unique brand and sell them in a unique way. So it's very natural for me.
So this is pretty amazing. This is the second generation of this car, which we first learned more than 25 years ago about the existence of an NSX. So tell us about the first generation's differences with this one.
The first generation NSX, of course, Honda and Acura were still a much younger entity, certainly with automobiles. It was our way to unleash all the best and brightest ideas within our company, to really let some young future leaders run with those ideas, and kind of to crystallize certain thoughts we had about automobiles and how they should.
Oh yeah,
the pictures of the old one up on the screen right now.
Yeah. In a similar blue, Laguna Seca blue, perhaps. And so to crystallize these philosophy. So Honda's famous for saying that philosophy without action is kind of worthless. But action without philosophy is kind of a lethal weapon. So we had these strong philosophies about automobiles, and the NSX allowed us to bring all those together in kind of a three-dimensional way and craft on them, so to speak, on behalf of drivers, special owners. And I think it was very therapeutic for our company back then, and it's turning out to be quite therapeutic again today.
So all aluminum for the first one. This one has a space frame structure and does use aluminum.
Yes. It's aluminum intensive.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the original took the state-of-the-art methods of joining materials and introduced aluminum into those methodologies. So now, many years on, many different extrusions, stampings, generally aluminum, also ultra-high-strength steel, a space frame to allow us to really give us flexibility in terms of how we join, getting maximum rigidity in the joints. For us, since the NSX is about experimenting with new technologies, really let us sink our teeth into how do we join together various dissimilar lightweight materials to prepare not only for the now, but the next generation.
Of all kinds of cars.
of all kind of structures, if you think about them, because we make a number of structures, you know. And so,
Ted, wasn't the original NSX also derived, at least in part, from Honda's racing expertise honed during the 80s in Formula One? And so it was partly a celebration of that expertise and that knowledge, and which is a little different from today's, because your involvement in racing has been different.
Yeah, I wasn't there.
You weren't there.
I weren't there. I joined the company in 1990, literally 10 months after seeing an NSX it was then called Detroit Auto Show. So I had about an hour silent conversation with that original car there on the stand and joined the company.
Is that what led you to join Honda?
It definitely influenced me. That and 86 Accord LXI and 88 Prelude SI. Mm-hmm. These were vehicles I benchmarked when I was working at the Chelsea Proving Grounds. And so,
with Chrysler then.
With Chrysler. Mm-hmm. And so I had an intimate understanding of their automobiles. And just seeing the NSX, there was this silent conversation. And as Joe's pointing out, Honda was... really a challenging company. I mean, what kind of company is making stuff like this is what I thought. And I'm not the only one to say that, because I steal that phrase from my good friend John Ikeda, who joined the company even before me in styling. So what kind of company just decides to start making automobiles just because the government says there's some limit on when they start making automobiles? So I started, after I touched their products,
We should elaborate for people who don't know that
right.
story. The Japanese government did not want right. Honda to make cars.
Well,
there were too many car companies in
correct.
Japan.
After World War II, the Japanese government wanted to focus their limited resources they had. And by limiting competition, they thought they could rebuild their country much more rapidly after the war. And in fact, there was an edict that if you weren't in production by a certain date, you couldn't make cars. And, you know, I love the reaction of Mr. Honda because he wanted to create all sorts of machines. He didn't want to limit the joy that Honda could create just by two wheels or three wheels or wheels at all, as we learned here recently. So, but coming full circle back to Joe's original question, that kind of unlimited potential of Honda Motor Company, whether it be racing, whether it has wheels or doesn't have wheels. Yes, the NSX was a way to, like I say, crystallize that. And I'm fond of saying that in many ways, making a road car is, in my opinion, much more challenging than making a racing machine. Because the lap time for a racing machine and the role and responsibility within that team, it's so clear-cut. It's still unbelievably difficult. And you could argue maybe the competition is that much harder in the racing sphere. But making a road car, what is the lap time? You know, how do you bring new value? In the race, you bring new value by winning. So you can recycle the successful technologies and evolve on them. So in any case, yes, Honda wants to crystallize its highest technology in the form of NSX and other special products, S2000 and other products. Mm. And we've sought to do that again. And yes, it derived a little less on some of those race-bred technologies. It's a little more out there. We're not doing Le Mans prototype racing, but a lot of the technologies we have on this vehicle could be similar to those type of technologies.
So the hybrid system that you guys are using on this is a technological tour de force in many ways. Explain the way you have motors that are assisting the engine in this car. Yeah.
So I'll start with the driver. So the most important thing about the motors assisting the driver is our longstanding exploration of active torque transfer. So active torque transfer, we wrote technical papers in the late 80s. We launched it on the Prelude.
Type SH,
that was a front-wheel drive, and where the right and the left front tires could rotate at different drive force.
Very big deal in its day.
Not a lot of torque, so when you don't have a lot of torque, it's hard to split the torque. So That was a limitation. And then we brought that to all-wheel drive with the Acura RL. And so that vehicle, now we had front and rear torque distribution. Then first and second generation MDX. First generation MDX, we had electromechanical, but we were just splitting it front to rear. Second generation MDX, we were actually splitting it side to side. Again, electromechanical. So what you have essentially with these three electric motors is the third generation of active torque transfer in many ways. The first generation of it being all electric motors. And the ability to split the torque to respond to all phases of driving. So if you accelerate, your two motors in the front are obviously creating a drive force. And the third motor, which I call an electric supercharger, is right directly on the crankshaft output, essentially spinning the crankshaft up, giving you a direct propulsion, you know, through the transmission back out through the drive shaft. So when you accelerate, all three making you go. When you brake, we have essentially a brake-by-wire system. We're recovering the front motor drive force. And then what is so neat is when you turn, these independent motors precisely responding to the drive force, really to give you the type of response you requested at the steering wheel.
You know, it's almost as if you've done too good a job on that. One of the criticisms of the car is that it doesn't feel like a nervous thoroughbred, like some of the more other exotics might feel. That, in fact, one of the criticisms of the car, which, and this criticism's not coming from me, but I'm sure you've read the reviews.
I'm very comfortable with criticism. So it's okay.
Good. Is that, my gosh, anybody can drive this car is kind of the feeling.
I would say I think some of that came from the initial launch event for the media for this car was a year ago, and you did come in for a lot of criticism, as John described. I wasn't on that event. I didn't drive early cars. At Road and Track, we just had the car for some tests about a month ago, and one of our main guys was on that event, and he was blown away because he said, this is so much different from a year ago.
Oh,
they've done
good.
A lot of work.
What'd you do different in a year's time?
Well, the software evolution and final execution, when we did first have the first journalist drive, was perhaps not at 1,000%, but the car was ready to have a journalist drive. So in the time since then, the final execution, final integration, you know, transmission, really fine detailed setting on the transmission, continued fine detail setting on really all of the systems, and of course all the final quality verification. So it's many little things, mm-hmm. as I think you know, but you know, a vehicle that is accessible is a highlight of Honda's core value, and a vehicle that responds very precisely to the driver's intention is getting closer and closer to Acura's core DNA. We're trying to craft technologies, not for technology's sake, but to precisely respond to the driver. And when you bring that to a sports car, there's kind of this timelessness of what makes great sports cars great. Because there's many, many sports cars. But there's only a few that really kind of touch people in a kind of a deep way, and it may be a lasting way. And so it's those sports cars where I call it the loop time between the driver's kind of imagined response and when they actually achieve that. And so if you can begin to close this loop time of driver intention, driver skill, and then vehicle skill, vehicle response, and bring that very closely in alignment, then it becomes this, instead of like a conscious driving experience, you can quickly acclimate, and it just becomes this unconscious thing.
I think you've created a car. It's very accessible to, quote, normal people. It's not an intimidating car to get into. I mean, you get in it, and some of the controls are familiar to anyone who's driven a recent Acura. The sight lines and the greenhouse is familiar from the original NSX, you know, a great view out the, you know, broad windshield. It feels very accessible. The more you drive it, the more accessible it becomes, and the more it the more performance is there for the driver. But even for a modest driver, there's a lot there initially. But I was with a group of people with varying levels of skills, including my boss, Kim Wolfgill, who's a former Daytona race driver. And as he spent several days with it, he was kind of blown away by how it kept revealing itself. There's more there, especially with the whole front motor thing. That's kind of the signature dynamic move of the cars, the way it comes out of corners because of those motors.
We call that peeling the onion. So we want to make the car accessible to everyone, but you want to make the car come alive really according to your own skill development. So in a way, it's this amazing vehicle every day. It does egg you on to explore a little deeper. And then as you develop this relationship with it, we call it peeling the onion. There's various levels of performance. But unlike an onion, it doesn't make you cry, so don't worry.
One level that was revealed to me is in the braking, and you've got ceramic discs as an option on this, too. Talk a little bit about that, because I got the chance to drive it at Lime Rock, and I've never experienced braking like that before on any car.
It really is amazing how we've brought together the very high-performance ceramic brakes as a mechanical friction system. The cooling is really an unsung hero. The way in which we cool the brakes and the balance of the cooling between the front and the rear, there's some very clever cooling ducts. I'd like to give a shout-out to chassis engineers because they actually ran cooling ducts off of the underside of the vehicle through a hollow aluminum subframe section and brought the cooling air directly on the rear brakes, as well as, you know, all our aerodynamicists and thermal guys just killed themselves on this project. So you have the cooling, you have the fundamental brakes, and then the way in which we seamlessly integrate the motor regenerative force with the braking force. Because when you have brake-by-wire, you can make any type of pedal feeling you want. So what pedal feeling makes you feel confident, secure, as you bomb around the track? So amazing fade, very consistent.
There was no fade in my experience. Right. No, I wasn't doing a full race, right? We could go out and do, I think, three laps at a time or something. But with heavy, heavy braking, there was zero fade whatsoever.
So building up that confidence, and hopefully the interaction with the pedal and the force and the response you got, even though it was a by-wire system, gave you confidence, gave you a sense of security. And that's an area where many months, day after day, head hitting the pillow, I wasn't sure if we were going to get there or not. And so were the guys. And so to go through that experience, that gauntlet, so to speak, to go back and get in touch with those fine details of the human, how they drive in terms of pedal force, it was a tremendous challenge, and I'm very proud of our accomplishment.
And the guys you're talking about, just to clarify, you're based in Ohio, and it's my understanding most of the powertrain was done in Japan, but you guys did the whole chassis structure, suspension, the car is basically done in Ohio with a powertrain largely developed in Japan. So this is like middle America project.
As you say, Joe, that's the simplest way to understand it. The powertrain's in Japan and the rest of the vehicles in the U.S. These are folks like me who love mechanisms, love cars. I've been here a little over 25 years and cutting my teeth on various things. And what's neat is the stuff we did on MDX was just as technically challenging and satisfying, and then you get to up your game again.
The MDX doesn't look quite like this.
It doesn't. But I will say we were just done talking about the brakes, and the brakes is a real crossover point between the complete vehicle dynamic and the power unit. And so the brakes, in a way, was in between, and so it was complicated. So we had members in Japan as well as local members here who had to do that integration. So it was very challenging just for communication, not just Japanese and English, but cultural sensibilities and what feels good to John or Joe or Gary or Ted. We don't always get along as human beings, so
Talk a little more about the airflow management of this car, because I mean it's rather interesting the way you guys have managed the way the air goes where it needs to be. I mean, you were just mentioning about the hollow subframe part for the brakes, but I mean for a supercar, you need to really do some fluid dynamics to make it work, right?
Yeah, the buzzword that we use is total airflow management. But that's a generic buzzword within our company or within the group. Total airflow management is simultaneously dealing with the airflow to cool the vehicle, to cool the brakes, to cool
here
the...
Here we've got a great graphic running, too, yeah. Showing it.
So this graphic was made together with our simulations groups to show the air not only going around the vehicle but through the front motor room. It has to reattach to the side of the car. So here you're going to fly through the front motor room. That's the main radiator cooler. You're coming out through the hood vent, pressing down on the front end, and you stay attached down the side of the car. The same molecule of air is now re-entering the rear motor room, and this one is going down and cooling across the exhaust system and coming out the rear of the vehicle. So this reusing and recycling of air in the total airflow management strategy, it was very challenging. And we did bring over members of our F1 team who, the global financial crisis caused a lot of negative things. One of the benefits was is that we had these wonderful skilled people.
Aerodynamicists.
And aerodynamicists, thermal management. And so we brought not a large number, embedded them in our team. They worked with our local members, worked with our scale wind tunnel here, as well as our thermal computational fluid dynamics and aero computational fluid dynamics. So we had to somehow blend those two, Gary, and it was challenging because it's the first time that we truly, like a race team, we depended on those simulations. Yes, we anchored them in the lab, but we didn't have a car. So the type of experiment that we had in the lab was not exactly the same as the car. So we anchored them with experiments in the lab, but we were making, like I said, just like a race team, making DIGO decisions on simulation. So that was challenging and exciting.
Hey, we got a lot more to talk about. Yep. Stay right where you are. I told you I was going to kick you off the show if you're boring. Guess what? Stay right where you are, because we got to take a quick commercial break. Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking all about the Acura NSX, Honda NSX, if you happen to be outside of North America. We just got a question from a viewer. You were talking about, working with Japan and, why the NSX here. And Rafi from Baton Rouge says, are vehicles made in a different country lower in quality than those made in their country of origin? Or is that just a wrong perception?
I can't speak for all companies, but for Honda and certainly for Acura, our manufacturing standard is a global standard. I would say that the main difference for different countries has not to do with the manufacturing technology, but more with those local countries' rules and regulations. So I think the U.S. standard for crash safety or European standards are quite a high standard. Those aren't held by all countries all over the world. Mm-hmm. Manufacturing standards equivalent, kind of local safety standards or government standards, different country by country.
So we talked this whole time. We didn't even talk the horsepower of this vehicle. That's astonishing to me. tell us about the power that we can get out of this car.
The power is 500 horsepower from the twin-turbo V6, the internal combustion engine. The electric motors add in total 73 horsepower, so the total power is 573. And power to weight ratio is kind of your mother's or your mother's metric, and then what's coming into focus now is the torque to weight, and then torque to weight as a function of RPM. So at 2,000 RPM, we have over 400 foot-pounds of torque. And so that's really what makes you feel your body in the seat. And the kind of this electrified response I think electrified response is maybe the key phrase. You know, the original one was really kind of a lightweight based response, and this one's an electrified response.
Is that because of that supercharger aspect you were talking about?
Correct. You not and, and other people do the same. You know, certainly the P1 and LaFerrari, this electric supercharger. But remember, you've also got the two front motors in the front providing an additional force. So all three of them really pushing you back in your seat. But then it's a little bit strange because it's kind of stretching you, pulling you forward because it's a front-wheel drive car. So anyone that has a rear-wheel drive experience knows what that feels like to have the vehicle sit down on its haunches and press you back in the seat. And those with the front-wheel drive experience are used to what it feels like for the front tires pulling. And those that have an all-wheel drive experience know what that feels like. So this is an active all-wheel drive experience. And so as the quicker and the more you move your foot towards the firewall, the quicker and the more you will feel your body mass in the seat. And the amazing thing is the same is true when you steer. You're kind of controlling your own little experiment here of how much do I want to feel my weight of my body in the seat.
You're going to ask something, Joe?
All within the speed limits.
I was just wondering, for comparison's sake, how much horsepower the original NSX had. I can't remember. It was like 200 and something.
I know that it could not be more than 300, because if you remember back then...
It began with the numeral 2.
Yes, it was a 270, and then we went up, to 290. But if you remember back then, the Japanese government was limiting everything to under 300 horsepower.
Oh, yeah.
That was like a... Yeah. I'm not quite sure the background of that, but that was the sensibility. So, yes, the NSX is a vehicle that never could be understood by numbers, 270, 573. It's really not a numbers game to us, and I'll tell a story.
It never is for Honda. I mean, really. It's not part of the Honda philosophy to be obsessed with numbers in that way.
Yeah. As engineers... We have to be obsessed with numbers.
Sure.
And we care about all sorts of lap times. But it's interesting how some numbers go in early on in the project. The layout, the center of mass, the load transfer on the tires, certainly the aerodynamics and the thermal management. Just carving out space for the driver is the first numbers, so to speak. And then I was going to tell a story about talking to Uehara. Uehara Shigeru is the leader of the original NSX. And I asked him, I said, so just about numbers, because we were early in the project and I wanted to find out about the original NSX. So how did you set your targets? Because we're a very target-based culture these days. He says, well, we really didn't have a 0 to 60 target. So I said, well, how did you decide the power output? He says, we spent a lot of time driving products and arguing about the type of power curve. You know, the type of initial response.
More the feel of it.
Correct. The compliance, how broad would the response be? And so, yes, more of the feel of it. So it's a little bit of both. And I think the result is this kind of sandwich that comes from, you can't ignore the numbers. They're important. You need a short, quick sense to give people a bragging right, a sense of confidence in your product. But at the other hand, you need to really deeply explore numbers, and it's this driving experience, ownership experience that emerges.
It's interesting what you're saying, because I learned that a long time ago, because you can get in cars that have very similar 0 to 60 numbers, for example, and one sounds like the engine's going to grenade any second, and the other gets there with no problem. You can have cars that generate similar G-forces, similar slalom times, and one feels totally out of control, and the other feels very complacent. So, yeah, it's not just the numbers. It's how you get to those numbers.
And for us, a sports car, the difference between a very accomplished GT machine and a sports car is a sports car has to be able to use that power in all phases. And so your favorite winding road, a public road, it might have some wet leaves, it might have some gravel. So making such a large number, for us, 573 is a large number. For the rest of the world, it's not. Making it accessible, making it truly accessible and really making you come alive as a human being while you're driving it. And I say, sports cars, some sports cars give you thrills by making you sweat. And I think if you crystallize down the Honda and the Acura approaches, we're really trying to give you a thrill by the absence of sweat. And I know that sounds so crazy. Like I say, I'm very comfortable making some of my purist friends uncomfortable. But for all my purist hill climb friends, I love sweating just like everyone else. I love it. But I also have come to say you are permitted to enjoy cars that don't make you sweat and make your brain just explode with, wow, this is great.
But could you sweat if you needed to sweat? I mean, if you...
This car will make you sweat.
Right.
You just need
but if you
just...
if you just wanted to drive it, right. You drive it
right.
Comfortable, fast.
Right.
Oh, you can drive it like... At low speed, you can drive it like any other Honda. It is very accessible.
Right.
But it... another thing I was just thinking when you talk about sweat, I'm thinking about sweaty palms, of course.
Yes.
And
yes.
I remember the NSX has a particularly nicely done steering wheel, which is, of course, a critical interface in a car, but some are better than others, and this one is really quite well done. There's the thicker parts where your hand naturally rests at the 9 and 3 are just right, and the thickness and everything. And not every sports car manufacturer does that as well. So that just starting with that initial interface that you grab when you get in the car before you even do anything.
I seem to recall you had something to do with that steering wheel.
It wasn't just me, but we all, that's the kind of sensitivity or intention with great intention. The steering wheel has great intention behind it. As if, if every customer could, grab a soft piece of clay and make their own personal steering wheel, that would be that much better. But you have to remember that we had to do that in conjunction with, we've essentially eliminated hand-over-hand motions with this vehicle. So you try to unwind this product, and there's a lot of really critical decisions that were made that were codependent. So we had this vehicle has a very quick steering ratio, and then we utilized the torque vectoring to make it even quicker, or in certain instances, we can control out-of-phase torque vectoring to make it very stable. And very comfortable. So
you're saying that no one's going to be doing a lot of...
Correct. Once you're out of the parking lot,
Once
you're out of your parking lot, you essentially do all your steering right here.
Sort of lock-to-lock, just a half turn each way.
Just right here. So it's like being in a single-seat racing machine, just like the NSX. Joe already mentioned the very thin A-pillars.
Which is a whole manufacturing story unto itself.
It is, and everyone thought we maybe couldn't reproduce that original NSX aura with modern roof crush standards. But again, there's these amazing people I get to work with every day that said, no, we're going to take that on. And like Gary said, we did a space frame, so we were able to connect that section into our space frame. And then we have the hood blisters. They look great. But they are amazing guides against the edge lines. Mm-hmm. And so that, again, is amazing how your brain can work with just some subtle guides. So you can almost imagine yourself being in a single-seat race car.
A la F1. Hey, we're coming down to the very end here, but we just got a question from Snarky Moose via Twitter, who wants to know, did the IndyCar engine design inspire the NSX engine?
All of our great... racing machines inspire us going forward. I think probably the one that was the closest was the 72-degree turbo V6 from F1 era. So we're a 75-degree V6, but certainly the Indy engine also has some inspiration in there as well, single-bank turbo and all. So, yeah.
Some of the same thinking, same kind of thinking.
And when you sit in a room with folks that have been part of those design teams, and they say, well, what about this engine? What about that engine? So there really are those type of inspirational stories. Some of the materials and some of the detailed performance requirements, just the durability requirements for this, the expectation is different. But the fundamental design approaches are quite similar.
What's the rev limit on this?
7,500. It comes up quick. So, and above there would be a future emotional opportunity, certainly.
So I read that this was originally going to have a transverse mounted, normally aspirated engine, and you guys switched to longitudinally oriented turbocharged.
It is true.
So how did that happen?
The short story is that we used the transverse engine to fully try out all the technologies. So we had a mule car, platform mule car. That mule car ran at Mid-Ohio. It had a kind of a sky blue wrap on it, and that had the three electric motors with the transverse engine. That was an amazing product, but it had a certain limitation in its performance. The packaging was unbelievably tight.
That was the transverse V6, right?
It was a transverse V6. So you had the engine, the transmission, and then the motor in between. So we had some packaging challenges, and we simply made the conscious decision in order to raise the total performance of the product and in order to have more flexibility thinking out into the future, we would turn the engine and transmission around. So, and then from an engineering standpoint, how did that happen? Well, we had to redesign.
Hence some of the delays for this.
So people don't understand, when you turn the engine around and you raise up the power, now we need more cooling. Now we started to change some of the side intakes. We changed the front air intake. Now we're back to our aerodynamics and our thermal equations. We're changing essentially every millimeter of the exterior while trying to keep the original design motif. And so that, but we did have our anchor there. We had our real physical anchor at that point, and we had our simulations. So,
but Ted, even before that, wasn't there a V10 prototype for this car?
That was a whole nother program.
That was from Japan.
Correct. And that was a whole nother program. So prior to the global economic collapse, a monster GT machine was the image for the second coming of NSX. V10 in the front, super handling all-wheel drive on the rear axle. But yes, that machine existed, and unfortunately it was caught up collaterally, just like the Honda F1 bar team. Those both went away.
That's part of the explanation for the delay and there being another NSX. All that stuff happening took years before we arrived.
So this is really sort of generation three along that route.
I agree, John. And when you say it's Gen 3, really what I'm saying is, as a company, we've never, ever seen Honda or Acura without such a pinnacle product. There's always that desire. There's always that simmering passion. And unfortunately, that one was not able to reach the customer. But this one is.
And maybe it's just as well, because this package is terrific.
Yeah, I'm much more fond that if you're going to do such a pinnacle product, that it be very, very much a focused sports car.
Not only that, but, you know, the whole performance world is going hybrid right now. So to have this, you know, three electric motors, as you say, one of them essentially an electric supercharger, that's absolutely the right car for the right time.
On point, yeah.
And when we first announced this product in 2012, it was not so easily understandable or accepted. So it's very, I'm very pleased with all of us, the purists, the open-minded purists, and the less open-minded purists, with all of us just kind of opening up our mind and thinking about how we can take sports cars into the future.
You also benefit from Porsche, McLaren, Ferrari have all come out with hybrid supercars in the interim, which, you know, quite frankly, helps pave the way for, because if you had come alone, it might have been a little too Honda way, you know, for.
It's true.
But I do think you benefit from that, and it's a good thing.
It is.
Well, not only that, but, you know, when you look at where Formula One technology is today, I mean, they're all hybrids. When you look at the Le Mans, you know, the pinnacle prototypes there, it's there. So, you know what they always say in this business, you don't aim at the target. It's a moving target. You got to aim ahead of it so that you're right there when the time comes.
Mm-hmm. And as a point of pride, you know, for all the people that might be wondering, do they want to drive this product or not? You know, the thing that we're most proud of, that I'm most proud of, is I think the NSX at its core is about turning and cornering, handling.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And so we're still the only vehicle that has this electric torque transfer in response to steering. So you really can't get that in the market other than this vehicle.
And in doing so, you really have brought something new to this segment. I mean, it's something different, and it feels different when you drive. So
with that, we're going to have to wrap this up. Ted Klaus, thanks so much for coming on the show and bringing an NSX along with you into the studio.
Looks great here, and, well, we look better next to it, so nice to be here.
It makes all of us look good. That's right. Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now, and we've got a lot more to talk about. Sit still. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
So we're back, and of course, always coming out of this break, it's time for Dr. Data to try to puzzle us with a number or two of his.
Yeah, we have many numbers on this one this week. It should be an easy one, okay, because you're going to see all of these numbers and all of these names, and you'll be able to quickly identify. So, Carmen, could you please bring up the first slide? So here we are. We start at Toyota at number 5, and we end at Tesla at number 100.
And we should announce there's, what, about a dozen car company names?
Toyota, Mercedes, BMW, Honda, Ford, Hyundai, Volkswagen, Nissan, Porsche, Kia, Land Rover, Mini, and Tesla.
And some number next to them. So I'm going to guess that's since Toyota's at 5 and Tesla's at 100, Tesla makes 100% electric cars. Is that the percentage of electric?
No.
No.
Way off.
Way off.
Joe, any idea? You may know.
The first thing that came to my mind was recalls, but
no.
That's not right.
No. All right. So every year, a marketing firm does an analysis of the most valuable brands in the world. So Carmen, bring up the payoff. So the best global brands. So they look at financial performance of the branded products and services.
This is all, not just automotive.
Not just automotive. The role the brand plays in influencing customer choice, the strength the brand has to command a premium price or secure earnings for the company.
So the fact that Toyota's number 5 is pretty big deal.
It's a pretty big deal because Apple's number 1, Google's number 2, Coke is number 3, and Microsoft is number 4. Okay? So that's,
I think any
part
automaker
of
would be happy to be number 5 in that group.
Yeah, I mean, and so Tesla made it this year. They do this every year, and so Tesla got on it this year. Now, one of the things that I thought was sort of interesting is that General Motors isn't on this list anywhere.
Or any of its brands.
Well, I saw Volkswagen is number 40.
Yeah. Right. And
it had
gone down.
Well, I immediately wondered if... Yeah,
Porsche's on there independently of Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, but it just... And Fiat's not on here, right? Or
FCA? That doesn't surprise me.
No.
That doesn't surprise me.
As a global brand, though?
No. Mm. These are admired brands.
Right.
Right?
So right. Yeah. I mean, and it's just... You know, the whole point of this exercise is to say that if you build your brand, that you're able to, command better pricing
for
things.
So Jeep would do better than FCA.
Yeah.
Ferrari would do
was
better
Jeep
than
on
FCA.
That list?
No.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah. And
I'm almost surprised that Tesla is not a little higher.
Well, as I say, it just eked in there this year.
Although I suppose globally it's not as well known as in Europe and North America.
Yeah.
Because if that were done just for North America, I think Tesla would be pretty high.
Right. But it's interesting that, that like with Toyota being number 5, Mercedes being number 9, in the top 10 of all of the conceivable brands, because, rounding out the top 10 are IBM, Samsung, and Amazon. So, I mean, all brands that are highly familiar to people who are, don't care about cars, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and to be able to position themselves in that top cadre is pretty interesting.
Well, especially Toyota. I can understand a Mercedes, a BMW, even a Tesla, a premium, blah, blah, blah. For Toyota to beat them all, that really says.
And how many car companies were in the
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
13 out of the top 100.
Pretty good showing for the global auto
good
industry.
Good for us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're still here.
Yeah.
Yes, we are. So that was our number for the week.
All right. So what else? What else grabbed your eye in the news this week, Gary?
Well, I thought it was fairly interesting that Carlos Ghosn made an announcement that they're going to be talking about the way that the Nissan will be able to accelerate the fortunes of Mitsubishi. Now, as you recall, earlier this year, they announced that they're going to buy 34% of Mitsubishi.
Which gives them total controlling interest.
Yes.
Under Japanese law, they own it for all practical purposes.
Right. And, so I was looking at the American market for Mitsubishi, which hasn't been particularly robust of late. So total sales so far this year are 74,351. And to put that into context, the total sales for the Mazda 3 are 47,131. So basically like a 200 vehicle difference, you know, all of Mitsubishi, one Mazda model, right?
The Mazda 3. And,
Mazda 3.
And Mazda isn't exactly the hottest-selling brand in the American
right.
market.
So last year, the total sales for Mitsubishi were 95,342, which is slightly less than the number of GMC Acadias sold, which was 96,393.
This year, so far, three-fourths of the way through the year, they're at 74,000.
Correct.
So they're on track to maybe be a little better than last year, but still... It's
right.
nothing like the glory days.
Right.
And at the risk of sounding cruel, when I think of Mitsubishi, I think, why does this market need them anymore mm-hmm. at all? And Nissan getting involved, doesn't that have more to do with Nissan's obligations in Japan to the Japanese industry and, you know, like... Because Japan Inc. likes to, it sometimes has to kind of take care of itself, of each other, or the government. This is my perception.
No. I think you're spot on. And I think your question about why would a Nissan even need a Mitsubishi in the American market is a really good one. Isn't it just going to compete with the Nissan brand?
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny because I've been around long enough now. I hire younger people, and when Mitsubishi comes up, and anyone under the age of 30, like, hardly even knows they exist.
Except
anymore.
For maybe the Evo.
Right, exactly. But I tell people who work for me, I'm like, you can't understand what a hot brand Mitsubishi was 25 years ago. It was like the Hyundai of its day, really, or even more exciting.
Even more exciting.
And more exciting. You know, and more exciting products.
They were trailblazers in both styling and technology
yes,
in the day.
Yes. And now they're nothing, you know.
Trendsetters even.
Yeah, totally. And they were very early on. Premium sport utilities with the Montero. The Montero was a highly desirable lifestyle vehicle in its day. The Eclipse Coupe was, you know, one of the hottest affordable sporty cars in its day in the early 1990s when I was young, you know. And it's hard to imagine that now
right.
from that brand.
But I mean,
other than the Evo, which has become... Well, isn't it?
It's out of production.
It just ended production anyway.
Right.
But even in the, you know, it's been a very much a niche product for a number.
So what accounts for that? I mean, is it that they had financial problems in the home market and couldn't do product development, or was it just?
Well, in America, their sales and finance arm kind of screwed things up too on the U.S. dealership level, didn't they? With a lot of bad loans and...
I think Gary hit the nail on the head, though. They had stopped being a leader in styling and technology, and you're probably right. They were running into some sort of financial issues. They didn't have the money to do it right, and then it became an incentive game.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember,
the product...
They had
zero down,
zero payments for
right.
a year.
The product problem.
In fact, they called it the Mitsubishi Zero.
Yeah.
Mitsubishi didn't
yeah.
call it that. Yeah. The rest of us in the media
You're
did.
Absolutely right. The product problems came before the sales and finance and marketing issues in America were in reaction to the poor product.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have... poor product, you have to give it away, basically.
So is there the possibility of bringing it back?
there's always the possibility.
All right, the likelihood.
Well, you know, the automotive business these days, right now, is a scale game. The more you manufacture, the more you drive down your costs, then you can compete that way. Clearly, I think that's what Gowen's looking for. He's made no bones about it. He wants other companies to join this alliance. And now Japan Inc., to use your term there, Joe, has essentially gifted him this car company, Mitsubishi. So he's getting it, you know, for not a lot of money, and now he's going to have more scale. But can he turn it around? I don't know. What's the benefit of getting a Mitsubishi that's no longer a designer technology
leader? And does he have to turn it around in America or maybe other markets?
Well, he said it was going to be a global thing, so he was including the U.S. market in that. So,
well, good luck.
But, here's a question. Speaking of scale, so last week, Ford of Australia stopped manufacturing.
Yeah. I thought that had happened already. I guess it was announced.
They didn't announce it.
Yeah, this was the finally, instead of job
so they,
one.
So they built the last Falcon XR6. The last one came off the line. Yeah. Okay, 91 years they were building cars in Australia. Okay, here's the question.
Probably a sad day, actually.
Okay, so it's all about scale. Why isn't it possible to have low-volume, profitable, flexible manufacturing, meaning you build cars for a market, the engineering can be done elsewhere, you know, I mean, all of those costs can be
amortized around
anywhere else, and you just build them. And they're basically saying, and so next year General Motors stops producing in Australia, and Toyota stops producing in Australia. Now, obviously, they know more about manufacturing than I do, but It just seems to me.
No, it's a great question, Gary. It's a great question because, yeah, if you go back 20 years ago, that's what everybody was saying about Australia. Here's this little gem of an auto industry, very low volume, highly innovative, and they really are. Tremendous engineering and design going on there. In fact, a lot of engineering and design is staying there, even though the manufacturing is not. But, yeah, everyone thought, to your point, production runs of cars, not out of the plants, but by model. You know, if you go back to the 1950s, you had a million Chevrolets. Now, if you look at a lot of models, I think the average model run in the U.S. market, average, mind you, is about 50,000 units. You'd think that'd be perfect for Australia, but it hasn't worked out.
So I just don't understand it. I don't understand why the costs would be less expensive to bring a car in than to build it where you're at.
I have no idea.
It just seems odd to
me. Well, one thing, remember, the Australian market is really small.
Right.
I mean, I keep telling everybody that Australia is a country the size of the lower 48 states with the population of Ohio and Michigan. I mean, there's about 21, 22 million people in...
Almost on the coast.
And that's... not even the population of Texas.
Distribution costs
are down. I mean, you know, California and Texas have greater populations than does Australia. And so when you start to see that scale,
right,
maybe that's why the numbers don't pencil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well might be. In other news, I thought this was rather fascinating, that the German Bundesrat passes a... it's not exactly a law, but...
A resolution
whereby they're saying by 2030, internal combustion engines will be banned in Germany. And they're now going to the European Union and saying, hey, if you guys are really serious about this global warming, greenhouse gas, that you guys are going to sign on to this thing. So they want Brussels to go along with them. What do you think? 2030, no more internal combustion engines?
Yeah, it's probably no. I'll tell you why. I don't know how long it takes to turn over the fleet in Germany, but in the United States, it's 20 to 25 years. So the cars that you're building right now today are on average, still going to be, some of them are still going to be around.
In 20 years.
In 20 years. So, you know, we're already well past 2030 at that point.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be a situation whereby you'd say, okay, if you are going to be building a car, this car must be powered by something else? So if you own a car, you bought a car last year, you're all right. A new car must be an electric-powered car.
By what date? You're saying
2030, or you can't drive it on the road.
I think you can drive it on the road. I think what basically it comes down to is the fact that if the three of us have a car that we bought in 2025 in Berlin, and we're planning on keeping it for another 5 years, we could. If we're Mercedes and we're going to be building new cars, we can't build new cars with internal combustion engines.
At what point?
At 2030.
So basically, under that plan, by approximately 2050, there would be no more internal combustion engines in Germany.
One would assume.
See, I think
you
this is
start somewhere.
And we've talked about this on the show before. They call these zero emission vehicles. They're not. In fact, Germany shut down all their nuclear plants. They're relying more on coal than they did 5 years ago, even though they've got all these windmills and solar power. And of course, that's going to increase in the future. I still wish regulators and legislators would say, what's the total life cycle carbon footprint of this vehicle? And that's got to be the real focus. And when I say life cycle, I don't mean cradle to grave, because the grave is what? It's the landfill. It's got to be a cradle to cradle, fully recycled, even if some of that recycling is in what they call an industrial loop. And unless you want to focus on that, you may not be making any progress. Ergo, a lot of energy goes into making batteries. Holy moly, are they energy intensive. And by the way, have you seen any battery recycling centers anywhere around? Probably not. I think there's two of them for lithium-ion batteries in the United States. So unless we want to look at this on a totally sustainable basis, saying that we're going to ban internal combustion engines, may not really be all that smart. Because I still remember one of the development houses, you know, whether it was, I think it was Ricardo, and this was like 5-6 years ago, maybe even more, they showed this twin turbo V6 that ran on ethanol. And it had, according to their calculations, a smaller carbon footprint from an emission standpoint than most electric cars would have on a nationally blended basis of where you're getting your electricity. So, you know, it all sounds good and environmental and green to say we're going to ban the ICE. It may not really be the solution.
Mm-hmm. It was a good press release, though.
Well, I think that these legislators probably needed something to do, and therefore
it might provoke discussion and. Yeah.
Well, but it was interesting. I mean, last week, and we talked
we're
about
talking
it.
About it.
Well, that I mean, it seemed that two of the big things at the Paris show were Mercedes and Volkswagen, both with their electric initiatives, saying that they were, you know, here are new sub brands, you know, the VW ID and the Mercedes EQ, and how they're really going to be
partially a reaction to Tesla as well, though. Mm-hmm. Don't you think? I mean, Tesla has the Germans have been scrambling to address Tesla, which they initially and understandably initially dismissed, and suddenly, you know, everybody who's driving a Tesla in America and Europe 10 years ago was driving or would have been driving an Audi or a Mercedes or a BMW or whatever premium vehicle. You know, Tesla's a premium sedan, and you know they are scrambling to.
Yeah,
to meet this.
Here's the statistic that set their hair on fire. In the U.S. market, half of all cars sold over $100,000 are Teslas.
Oh, I didn't even need to.
And it has absolutely commanded 50% market share in all vehicles over $100,000 in the American market alone.
Which is...
That scares the hell out of them.
As it should.
Which basically means all German cars.
Right. Yeah, right. Right. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Say what you will about Tesla. That's... The 10 years ago, Tesla didn't even exist.
Right.
And that's profound.
Very know. Much.
I mean, Lexus didn't even come close to do... I mean, Lexus was very successful, but... And still is, but... Tesla, that's amazing.
Truly. I mean, when you have Porsche chasing you,
right?
I mean, it's just like, right. When does that happen? Some guy who's out in California that no one had ever heard of before.
For the Germans of all people to be reacting to an outsider, you know, outsiders are supposed to react to what the Germans do and mm-hmm. try and duplicate their brilliance and.
But maybe this 2030 thing will happen, and basically all the German companies will say, you know what, we're going to lead the world in this.
Well, they are saying it, actually, and you know it's amazing to see Germany declare that as a country. But remember, there's a handful of European cities that have already set this as a goal, including London, Paris, Oslo, Madrid. and I'm sure there's others as well. Those are the ones I can rattle off the top of my head, who are saying, we want to ban the internal combustion engine from our city center. We just want it gone. So, you know, some have been thinking all along, well, there's where you have your hybrid system, right? You get to the city center, you run pure electric. When you got to go on a long haul, the ICE kicks in. But this is very much there's a groundswell to say, yeah, let's ban this engine.
It's an opportunity for Volkswagen to get beyond diesel.
Absolutely, you know. Absolutely.
Well, that's why they've announced 30 electric models in, what, the next 10 years, was it? I mean, some...
I think it was 25. And, it's all about this.
Well, yeah. I question whether they're even going to have the money to pull that off.
Yeah.
Some electric models, yeah, 30, I'm not so sure.
It's all on the architecture, John. You got that MEB.
Right. Yeah, so much for MQB.
That's right.
Boy, look how many billions of euros that saved him, he said sarcastically.
Mm-hmm.
Did they actually come out with MEB, or is that a joke?
No, that's...
Yeah, they did.
Yeah,
okay.
they had new architecture for their electric vehicles.
Hey, another thing that caught my eye this week, curious about your guys' reaction, at the opposite end of the spectrum of where we've been talking, the Ram pickup outsold the Silverado. We saw this gigantic bump up in sales.
In the last month, in September.
Yeah. So it was 47,792 Rams versus 45,380 Silverados.
But the Ram number is like a 30% jump. Now, we know how they got it.
From month to month.
From year to year.
September to September.
So they threw an extra $1,000 on the hood in incentives. And I thought, now, why are they doing this? Why? And if you add it all up, that's an extra $46 million for one model for 1 month. It's a real expensive way to sell trucks. And what hit me is, oh, September, last month of the third quarter. Ooh, they had to, because as you guys know, you book the sale when it goes to the dealer. You book the profit. So it looked to me, if I'm reading this right, that they all of a sudden went, holy moly, we're going to miss our numbers for the quarter. Ooh, hit the accelerator on the Dodge incentive or the Ram incentives and let's get these trucks going.
Sounds entirely plausible.
See, but the question I have, though, is, okay, for the year, Silverado is down 3.5%. So why is Silverado, I mean, and if we look at for the year, Ram is up 8%, the pickup. So, I mean, what's wrong with Silverado? Is Colorado eating its lunch?
I don't think so.
Silverado's a little older. There's a new one coming.
You know, I think the answer myself would be in GM's made no bones about it. We're backing off fleet sales. We want to do more and more retail. And my guess is, because I don't have the breakdown between fleet and retail, but because they've been so loud about backing off fleet, and if you back off fleet in the truck segment, you know, you're really hurting your sales.
Mm-hmm.
The real interesting thing would be to look at what are actual transaction prices. You know, which truck line is really generating the most money for the company that makes them? Because even if you look at F-Series sales, if you combine Silverado with the GMC Sierra, and they're the same truck, they run down the same line, right? GM sells more pickups than Ford does. So I think the real measure at the end of the day, from a business standpoint, which truck is generating the most profit for the company that sells them? And if GM is increasing its transaction prices by backing down fleet, they may not care too much. And nobody likes to see their sales go down, but that may be an issue that they're more than willing to accept.
But isn't a lot of this just about bragging rights?
I don't think Detroit indulges in the crosstown sales bragging as much as it used to, like 20 years ago. I think they've learned that takes them down a path of, you know, incentivizing and not profits, but just a number. Mm-hmm. If anything, you would think Chrysler, with their recent problems with sales reporting, is being super careful about, you know, not wanting to just create things out of thin air.
But, you know, that may be another reason why they tapped the accelerator on incentives. because if not for that huge jump in Ram sales, their sales for the month would have been off significantly.
Right.
In fact, Jeep sales, Wrangler was down, Grand Cherokee, or Cherokee was down, and maybe Grand Cherokee too. But
the only thing, let's see, Patriot was up remarkably, 33%.
Yeah, maybe they tapped that accelerator,
and,
too.
And Grand Cherokee was up 18%, but you had the Compass was down, the Wrangler was down, the Cherokee was down, and the Renegade was down.
Yeah. So Jeep was down for the month. I think that's the first drop 3%. We've seen in Jeep sales since the great collapse, you know, the great recession. So that might have been another reason why they said, let's goose those sales of the Rams, because otherwise, everybody will say, wow, did their sales go down because of the new sales reporting system that they've got. But I still think it's got more to do with financial numbers than anything.
Interesting that they can tweak that, you know, a $46 million maneuver. But sometimes you got to do it.
Money in the couch cushion. They just pulled it out.
You know, I talked to Joe Hinrichs. This goes back a couple of years ago. And he said, John, it's so easy if you get towards the end of the month and you see that you're a little bit short, he says, you can just tap the accelerator. We can get 2,000 F-Series sales like that. He said, it's so easy to do, you have to resist the temptation. You have to. Because all you're doing is pulling sales forward and you're going to pay for it somewhere down the line.
Right.
But he says, if you need them, boom, you just tap it and you're there.
Wow.
Well, it's pretty amazing. The sales of the Ram pickup last year in September were 37,000, and here they are a year later, 47,000,
10,000 more trucks in 1 month. I'm telling you, that was not an accident. There's a reason behind doing that, and it's not a good reason. They're doing this for bad reasons.
And isn't it funny we refer to them as Chrysler?
Old habits die hard.
Does the average person even know what FCA is?
No.
I don't think they do.
No, not
so
at all.
I hesitate to use that term. We hesitate to use it in the pages of Road and Track to just refer to FCA. I mean, we do, but every time I see it, I wonder, like, okay, probably at this point,
our readers know
what it is.
The after-hours viewers, the readers of Road and Track,
But your average American, don't know what FCA means.
No. Another statistic that blows my mind, 40% of the American public don't even know what Kia is.
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised by that.
I am. I mean, after the hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising and, you know,
Well, that brings you back to your earlier question, Mitsubishi, is it worth saving? Well, it is a brand, and the brand, the recognition factor for that brand might be higher than Kia. I don't know.
It probably is.
You know, so that's one reason you keep a brand like that or reinvigorate a brand like that, because it is a brand.
We go to the interbrand thing. Kia beats Land Rover, Mini, and Tesla. So,
it's
number 69 on the list. Land Rover 78, Mini 88, Tesla 100. So,
Kia is among the top 100.
Yeah.
But Jeep's not on there?
No.
Okay, I don't know what the methodology is. Yeah.
No, I mean, they've been doing this for years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very telling.
Wow. What other numbers you got?
I got all kinds of numbers in here.
Hey, we've hit our time allotment here, though. We're going to have to wrap this up. Joe, thanks for coming on, man.
Oh, absolutely.
Great having you here. Great having you. Oh. Good questions for all about the NSX there as well. And then, Gary, you and I got to do this in another week.
Why don't we do that?
Yeah.
It'll be great.
It will be great. It's fun to do. Okay, signing off. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at AutoLine.tv.